Whenever I recall the past, it seems to me as if I am now existing in another world. I say that the students of today are 1,000 times blessed in every respect, because at the time of our student life, we had no better ships than a few sailing boats for going abroad. It was in the year of the Bunkyu era, 37 years ago, that I sailed on a foreign tour. I was living in Kyoto, the former imperial capital, just when the feeling towards expelling foreigners reached its climax. There were two parties of politicians at that time. The object of one was to carry out the principle of seclusion, while that of the other one was to open up the country to trade. The former was stronger than the latter. Those who belonged to the former party cried out, "Expel the barbarians," and the plan for successfully carrying out their end was simply to defend the country with guns. The material for these guns was to be obtained from the hanging bells of all the temples of Japan. So there were very few who dared venture to express themselves in favour of opening up the country, for fear they would be murdered for doing so. As it was then strictly forbidden by the Tokugawa Regency for anyone to go abroad, it was necessary for us to disguise ourselves as merchants and not to wear our two swords. When entering Yokohama, we put up at a hotel. In the meantime, we had often gone out shopping into the foreign concession. To tell the truth, the settlement was not so prosperous as it is now, there being only a few foreign houses scattered here and there. Though we had to clothe ourselves in European style, yet we could not get any new suits of clothes ready-made, but only second-hand ones, such as are demanded by sailors only, and we could not find any better boots than those of such a size that we could put both of our feet in at once. Then, as we had not yet our hair dressed in European style, no wonder we appeared quite strange, both to Europeans and natives, when we wore foreign clothes and boots. While we were waiting for the captain, we managed to get our hair cut in European style. Although our physicians of the time had their hair cut off, I may safely say that we set the first example to the nation for dressing the hair in European style. It gave a very strange feeling when we touched our heads, and at the same time, we felt very much embarrassed when anybody looked at us. The Meiji period took Japan from a feudal society with little contact with foreigners to winning wars against Russia, all in only 50 years. Sometimes everything happens all at once, and it can leave you feeling a bit overwhelmed. A few friends who were willing to go abroad with me were fortunately found. To mention their names, there were Kaworu Inouye, still living, the late Masari Inouye of the railway office, the late Yozo Yamane, and the late Kinsuke Endo of the coinage office. So we were five. Sad to say, I was something like an absconder, having had no permission to go abroad, while the four others had obtained private orders to go from the daimyo of the Choshu clan. In attempting to take voyage, there had arisen a difficulty, for I consulted Genzui Kusaka about the matter. I was a member of his party, whose principle was to expel all foreigners at any cost. I was told by him that it was too late for me to attempt going abroad owing to the unrest existing in the country, but I was trying my best to accomplish my desire, and I was not disappointed, for Inouye and others were eager to take me to Europe with them. We were very few who would go abroad, but at present those who go across the ocean can clothe themselves in foreign attire in their native places and have splendid ships for travelling in. What an enviable condition of affairs it is when compared with the epoch of our student life, and important scientific and literary works in abundance are imported, and an endless variety of translations are published, so that they can study any subject they like. We had only an English dictionary, translated by Tatsunosuke Hori before we went abroad. As there were very few who could understand English well at that time, many mistakes naturally found their way into this rare and costly book. As we were then obliged to take a foreign steamer, we had, of course, to apply to a foreign shipping company near to Custom House. There was one, known among Japanese as the English Number One Firm in Yokohama. As I was acquainted with the manager and employees, and there was an English gentleman by the name of Girl in that office who could speak Japanese very well, I applied directly to him for our tickets as soon as I could. Our application being readily granted, we got our 6,033 ryu exchanged for dollars through him, and so we had $8,330, most of which we had changed for bills of exchange. The money which we kept in our pockets was very little, but enough to cover all the petty expenses which the journey necessitated. As it was nearing 12 o'clock, the English gentleman by the name Girl came out of his room to meet us there, and directly gave us a flat refusal, saying that it was quite unlawful for him to take us out of the country from which people were strictly forbidden to go by the Tokugawa Regency. He added that he could not guarantee whether or not he could safely get passage for us. Then I was greatly disappointed and said, if we don't go, we are ruined and disgraced. So much so that we have no alternative but to end our lives ourselves here, because if we go home with this semi-foreign appearance, we shall certainly be killed as spies. So we had better die at this moment than be brought up to the court, making a sorry, crestfallen picture, and be sentenced to death. Just at the moment when all of us were going to lay our hands on our swords, the Englishman in question was much terrified, and said, "Do not go to such an extreme, but wait a moment while I go back to my partner." After another consultation over the matter, to our great relief, we were immediately told we could go. As soon as we had safely entered the dock at London, some customs officials came on board to examine our luggage, from the largest down to the smallest package. An Englishman, who was once a captain of a steamer owned by the English number one firm in Yokohama, came on board to guide me to the town, and I was very glad to follow him to a place called the Tower of London and put up at a hotel in American Square, where seamen used to resort. The next morning, I was taken by him to a barber, a tailor's, and a shoemaker's. After that, I appeared like a gentleman. To tell the truth, I was not soon able to read the London Times, though one day a member of the family I was staying with, who was reading a paper, asked me where my native place was. "Choshu," I responded, and he asked again whether Choshu was not the same as Shimonoseki, where a foreign ship was fired at by the natives. Being surprised to hear of the event, I borrowed the paper and asked Masaru Inouye to read it to me. He read that the Parliament of England was discussing the question of sending an expedition to chastise the Choshu clan. Before this, I had been shown into the observatory at the Kew Gardens, the arsenal at Greenwich, a few shipbuilding yards, and several other important buildings, spending many Sundays, so the greatness of England was thus vividly in my mind. I therefore thought that the Choshu clan was blindly planning to fight with such a powerful country as England, without considering fully the danger. It was quite plain that the Choshu clan would lose the day should such a war began, and consequently, the country would be ruined. Thereupon, Inouye and I thought that it was not necessary for us to continue our studies in England while our country was endangered. So we made up our minds to go home at once in order that we might be instrumental in dissuading the Choshu clan government from carrying out the principle of seclusion, even at the cost of our lives. On my taking leave of Professor Williamson, I was kindly told by him that I ought to stay with him a little longer in order to continue my studies, as it was impossible for me to secure a peaceful settlement of the controversy since we were too young for such a heavy task. But on my saying that nothing could prevent me from carrying out my desire of going home, the professor at once yielded to me, and accordingly he got passage for us back home. When we landed at Yokohama, we put up at a hotel where foreigners used to resort, for fear our lives would be endangered in case it should be known that we were just landing from a foreign vessel. On landing there, we were surprised to see great excitement prevailing throughout our clan. The purpose of expelling foreigners reached its focus, so that women as well as men were ready to fight at any moment, staying powerfully armed with long lances and dressed in a way to make their movements easy, and having white cloth bandages round their heads, with their sleeves folded up to their shoulders by strings. We wore the summer clothes which we bought at Yokohama, but we had neither hakuna, trousers used for ceremonial occasions, nor two swords, and our hair was still dressed in foreign style. Fortunately, a friend of mine was then governor of Mitajiri, and with his help we transformed ourselves back into samurai, with hakama, hawori, and two swords. Towards evening, we arrived at Yamaguchi and put up at a hotel, and the next morning I met up with Mori, a friend of mine who was serving in the Daimyo's retinue, and asked him to let us see the Daimyo personally, even if we should be killed in front of the master. Then he said, "I fully sympathize with your loyal spirit in coming back home on hearing of the unrest of the province. Be assured that I will manage to let you have the pleasure of seeing your master." And so the next day we were called up to the official residence of our daimyo, and in the presence of the daimyo and ministers we spoke for nearly 4 hours about the greatness of European civilization. We'd also taken a map, which helped us a great deal in telling the experiences we had in Europe. Further, we related what we had seen in terms of size and construction, as well as the architecture of the 18 warships, which, anchored in the Yokohama harbor, had the intention of bombarding Japan in a few days, and showed the hopelessness of resistance against them. At the same time, we tried our best to restore the imperial power. By so doing, Japan might have one able central government instead of a feudal system, which only rendered the government unable to withstand the demands of the foreign powers. In the meanwhile, the debates and discussions of the clan had begun to take another direction. The Daimyo's guards had a suspicion that Inuye and I were responsible for the change of policy on the part of the clan, so they determined to assassinate us. Being much surprised, Inuye said, as we have returned from Europe for the purpose of aiding in an amicable settlement of affairs, and now we find our lives in danger, it would be better for us to end our own lives, rather than die at the hands of an assassin. I replied, "Under the existing circumstances, we shall surely die, so it will be better for us to await the assassins if they will come tonight, and abide by the result, than to end ourselves now." Fortunately, we were not driven to this extreme, as the clan government forbade any violence against us. At that time, the general opinion of the people of Japan could not be reached. The Tokugawa Regency decided to open the country to trade, but some people were still urgent in their desires for the expulsion of foreigners, and thus no debate of any clan government ended with satisfactory results. So it was a very difficult matter to enter into final negotiations with the foreign powers. In the meantime, the imperial power was restored, owing to the weakness of the Tokugawa Regency, which was the result of 300 years of tranquility in a dream of eternal peace, and thus the samurai lost all their former vigour and power. At last, the shogun was obliged to go up to Kyoto and hand over all power to the emperor. By this time, the feeling concerning the expulsion of foreigners had completely changed in favour of opening up the country. Before the restoration, our names were different. Kido was called Kogori Katsura, Zoruko Murata was called Masujiro Omura, and I was named Uichi Hayasha. When I was called to the imperial court in its first year of Meiji, I was called Shinsuke Ito, so I did not change the name. Both at the restoration and in the Fushimi War, I was at home, because I intended to establish a school where English should be taught at Matajiri, and an American followed me there, who wanted to be employed by me. I took him to Yamaguchi, and there I established a school. It was the 11th of January, in the year of Ubushin, when I went again to Kobe. I was surprised to see that the town was filled with foreign forces, while the people there were greatly excited. The restoration of the imperial power and the new government was recognized by the powers. As there was no system settled, I was temporarily appointed Secretary of Foreign Affairs. In May of the same year, the clan system was totally changed into a provincial one, and I was appointed governor of Hyogo. Although I was the promoter of the new system, I experienced a difficulty in carrying it out, because neither the imperial court nor the clans had considered it fair. Wherever I went, my opinion was perceived with displeasure. Some, Shizoku, samurai before the restoration, had vague expectations of being granted a large annual stipend each. So they did not agree with me, for fear they should lose their imaginary profit in the event of the clan system being dispensed with. We were planning to introduce a railway system into the country. We occupied ourselves in laying a railway between the imperial capital and Yokohama from the second year of Meiji, and at length succeeded in this work, though we met almost insurmountable difficulties. As we had no studies in economical and budgetary questions, I had to go across to America for the purpose of investigating both. Fukichi, Yoshida, and Yoshikawa accompanied me on this journey. We were thus able to get a general idea about taxes, paper currency, income and expenditure, yearly budget, the system of national banks, superintending the budget office, custom houses, etc. I also did not miss the opportunity of studying the American Constitution, and thus Count Okuma was able to issue paper money. And afterwards, we determined to establish national banks for giving protection to the value of the paper currency. And in the 16th year of Meiji, I returned home for the purpose of starting my draft of the proposed Constitution of Japan. To tell the truth, this attempt of mine was exceedingly hard. In the event of George Washington rendering his services for his country and adopting a constitution, those who rendered him assistance were great scholars, such as James Madison of Virginia and Alexander Hamilton of New York. In 1787, they published a book containing their own views regarding the Constitution in New York. That book is now kept in my library and tells me that they were indeed great scholars who nobly performed their duty for their country's sake. Though a republic is quite useful for a smaller country, there had been very few instances in the world of it being well suited for any large country. So it was very hard for them to adopt a republican form of government for their country, and I could not but highly praise their rare abilities for having done so, and to such good advantage. The advent of Commodore Perry, followed by a rapid succession of great events too well known to every student of our history to be repeated here, roughly awakened us to the consciousness of mighty forces at work which were changing the face of the outside world. We felt the contact with irresistible forces which were certain to draw our country very soon into the cauldron of international competition. In face of this revelation, we had to confess to ourselves that we were ill-prepared to bear the brunt of those forces. So, first of all, the whole fabric of the feudal system, which with its obsolete shackles and formalities hindered us at every step and in every branch of free development, had to be uprooted and destroyed. I must, however, dissuade my readers of the very common idea that there was no education and an entire absence of Japanese public spirit during feudal times. It is a false impression which has led superficial observers of our country to believe that our civilization has been so recent that its continuing is a doubtful problem, the ultimate solution of which can only be judged by future events. In short, that our civilization is nothing but a hastily donned, superficial veneer. On the contrary, I am not exaggerating when I say that, for generations and centuries, we have been enjoying a moral education of the highest type, developed and sanctified under the comprehensive name of Bushido, offering us splendid standards of morality, rigorously enforced in the everyday life of the educated classes. The result, as everyone who is acquainted with old Japan knows, was an education which aspired to the attainment of stoic heroism, a rustic simplicity and a self-sacrificing spirit unsurpassed in Sparta and the aesthetic culture of Athens. The government tried its best to train the mass of the people to modern ideas of public and political life. They were slowly but steadily led to extend their vision beyond the pale of their village communities, to look upon the affairs of their districts and prefectures as their own, until finally they could interest themselves in the affairs of state and nation as strongly as, or even more strongly than, the affairs of their own villages. And now, looking backwards over 16 years of its successful operation, it is not without a certain degree of gratification that I feel the experiment has been, in spite of its many shortcomings, upon the whole, a success. At all events, I believe that I am justified in considering that the present state of popular sentiment, when even the poorest peasant feels the importance of the events in which the country is playing a predominant part, the popular feeling which regards the present gigantic undertaking of our country both as a national affair and as an affair in which he is personally closely interested. In short, the strong and intensely united public opinion backing the executive department in this supreme moment of our national existence would not have been possible, at least to an equal degree, but for the habitual and active participation of the entire country in the management of its public affairs. That is to say, in a constitutional and representative form of government.